Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton. When fellow alcoholic king and brother-in-law, Christian IV of Denmark, came to visit England in 1606, the king treated him to a night of debauchery, in the middle of which a court play was performed. While two women played characters called Hope and Faith were found vomiting in the hallway, a character called Peace was found whacking people with her olive branch. The increasingly Puritan court in attendance were far from amused. Throughout his life, James was a remarkable phenomenon, a king with an enormous literary output. His range was astonishing. He was a master poet, a translator, a theologian, a political theorist, and a shrewd politician. He was determined to unite the kingdoms of England and Scotland under one banner. His belief in the divine right of kings meant his relationship with Parliament would be bitter, sour, and destructive, with consequences long outlasting the reign of the first King of Great Britain. This is James I. James was born in Edinburgh Castle on the 19th of June 1566. He was born heir apparent to the Scottish throne. His mother was Mary, Queen of Scots. His father was Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley. Both of his parents were great-grandchildren of Henry VII of England. This meant he was a strong claimant to the English throne, with an impeccable bloodline. He was said to be well-proportioned and likely to prove a godly prince. He was baptised in a Catholic ceremony, with Charles IX of France and Elizabeth I of England acting as godparents. The customary spit in the mouth was refused by his mother, as the Archbishop was described as a portly priest. James would have a dreadful childhood. In a classic whodunit, his father, Lord Darnley, was murdered. He was found in his garden following an explosion at his house, though he bore no marks. Mary then got married to the chief suspect, Lord Bothwell, just a few months later, in June 1567. A shocked public began to display murder placards around Edinburgh. The extreme anti-Mary camp would claim the murder was the result of an illicit affair between the two and was planned meticulously. The pro-Mary camp would claim her complete innocence. They would also claim that Mary was effectively kidnapped by Bothwell and kept prisoner. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. Nevertheless, Mary, being an ardent Catholic in a Protestant kingdom, meant she would always have enemies at her own court. The debacle would mean the final straw for a fraught reign. A peer revolt just weeks after her third marriage resulted in her capture. She was given the choice: abdicate in favour of her son James, or face a trial with a possible execution for the murder of Lord Darnley. She chose to abdicate in favour of her 13-month-old son. In May 1568, Mary escaped and raised 6,000 men, only to be defeated at the Battle of Langside, after which she fled south of the border to be kept in honorary confinement by her cousin and rival, Elizabeth I. James would never see his mother again. James was crowned King of Scotland at the Church of the Holy Rood in Stirling on the 29th of July, 1567. In the absence of his Catholic mother, James would be raised as a God-fearing Protestant by the Earl and Countess of Mar in the security of Stirling Castle. He would not be afforded the comfortable life of previous child kings. His tutor, Buchanan, would beat him regularly with a fair degree of sadism. He would tell the young James that his adulterous mother had murdered his father. For the rest of his life, James would shudder if he saw anyone who resembled the bestial Buchanan. Despite the scars, James was not discouraged in the pursuit of knowledge. He was very intelligent from a young age, and a talented linguist like the Tudors. In the 1580s and 90s, he promoted literature, publishing Some Rules and Cautions to be Observed and Eschewed in Scottish Prosody at the age of 18. The poetic description was in his mother tongue, Scots. His political circle was no less vicious than his education. He watched as 3 out of his 4 regents were violently killed. First, the Earl of Moray, his uncle, was killed in 1570 by one of Mary's supporters. He became the first head of government to be assassinated with a firearm. Next was Matthew Stuart, the Earl of Lennox, James's paternal grandfather, killed by another Marian loyalist during a raid of Stirling Castle, in the same fashion the following year. Next was a man who had helped raise James, the Earl of Mar. He died in 1572 after a short, vehement illness. His final regent was James Douglas, the Earl of Morton. While successful in ending the Civil War, which had rocked Scotland and eliminated James's regents, he fell out of favour with James when Esme Stuart, a cousin of James's father, arrived in Scotland. The exotic French nobleman quickly won over the 13-year-old king. Stuart, 37, was distrusted by the Scottish court due to his close relationship with the teenager. He was even accused of drawing the king into carnal lust due to their physical displays of affection. One of Stuart's associates accused Morton, James's regent, of being involved in Lord Darnley's murder. He was executed by means of a Scottish maiden, an early form of a guillotine. Stuart had eliminated a rival. By Morton's execution in 1581, James was an adult ruler, having been proclaimed 2 years earlier, yet he was hugely under the control of Stuart. A man James had showered with gifts, including the jewels from his mother's collection. He was also made the new Earl of Lennox in 1581, and then a duke. Though a Protestant convert, he was at least sympathetic to Catholicism. The idea of a Catholic duke irked the Scottish nobles, who were already appalled at his success in manipulating the young king. They acted. In August 1582, the king was lured to Ruthven Castle. There he was kept a prisoner by several Presbyterian nobles. They intended to prevent all French or pro-Catholic influences from infiltrating the kingdom, keeping the king effectively prisoner and ruling Scotland for 10 months. They also forced the king to banish Stuart. In June 1583, the king was released and would rule the kingdom outright. James's reign in Scotland was characterised by increasing sure-footedness, encountering powerful aristocrats and power-seeking clergy. He largely kept out of disputes, resulting in reasonable stability and lifting his own status as the omnipotent political entity. By the late 80s, the big question facing the king was around marriage. In August 1589, a suitable match was found. Anne of Denmark, daughter of King Frederick II. They were formally married at Bishop's Palace in Oslo in November, returning to Scotland the following year. Anne was immediately under pressure to produce an heir. After several failed attempts, rumours began to spread of James's apparent homosexuality. The people remembered how close James had been to his cousin Esme Stuart when he was a teenager. The couple didn't live together, and Anne only rarely accompanied the king on royal duties. In February 1594, the country drew a sigh of relief when Anne gave birth to a boy called Henry. The country could do without a further power vacuum had something happened to James. The decision to place the young prince in the care of fervent Protestant the Earl of Mar drove a wedge between the king and Anne, a queen whom many considered to be a secret Catholic. Nevertheless, a second child was born in 1596, Elizabeth, followed by another son in 1600, Charles. After visiting Denmark in 1589, James became fascinated with witchcraft. He was informed that the storms encountered on the journey were a result of witches. James would supervise the torture of the accused women. Of the remainder of his rule in Scotland, over half of those accused of witchcraft would be brought to flames. He would become sceptical later in life. In 1597, James began work on Basilican Doran, a treatise on government. It was a manual on the powers of a king and how to be a good monarch, written for his son and heir, Henry. He emphasised justice and equality, the need to invite foreign merchants, to base currency on gold and silver to maintain a healthy economy, to visit all kingdoms every 3 years to be fully acquainted with the needs of the people, and to choose a spouse with whom you share a religion. Most crucially, the manual reinforced the divine right of kings. It rejected outright any papal authority. According to James, kings are justly called gods, resembling divine power on earth. They have the power of raising and casting down of life and death. Judges over their subjects accountable to God only. This strong belief in kingship would have fundamental effects on English rule in the 17th century. By the turn of the century, James had one focus, succeeding Elizabeth as the English monarch. As early as 1600, James was in secret negotiation with Robert Cecil, Elizabeth's Secretary of State, about how to succeed her. While Elizabeth had always refused to name her successor, she did say of James, "Unless he gives me due cause, I won't hinder him." The door was ajar. Cecil advised to flatter the aged queen. At least as early as the 1580s, James was keen to stay on Elizabeth's side. When his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, was executed in 1587 for continually plotting against Elizabeth, James offered no protest. It was a mother he never knew. It was crucial for James not to do anything to jeopardise his chances of becoming King of England. On the 24th of March 1603, Elizabeth died. Cecil had horses stationed every 10 miles all the way to Edinburgh, so the news would reach James without delay. He then proclaimed James as king on the same day as Elizabeth's death, first at Whitehall and then at the gates of London, leaving little time or opportunity for a Catholic cause to seize control. It was a remarkably smooth transition, not only of monarchs, but of dynasties. James left for England on the 26th of March. When he arrived at York, the first request of the Privy Council, who had travelled up to meet him, was to help him clear his debt. It wouldn't be the last time. On the 25th of July 1603, James I was crowned. He was a great-great-grandson of Henry VII, on both his mother's and his father's side. He was rich in royal blood. Just like the Tudor monarchs before him, James inherited a kingdom beset with problems. It was riddled with debt after war with Ireland. Elizabeth's attempts to sow religious divisions had failed, and with money drying up, she had become more and more dependent on Parliament for money. James would also have to deal with being a foreigner. Most who met James had only known Elizabeth as monarch. He was Scottish, a country with whom England had been at intermittent war for centuries. Perhaps it was for this reason that pragmatic James quickly decided against giving senior government roles to Scots. Yet the council were largely optimistic. The 37-year-old had proven to be an adroit leader. According to historian John Phillips Kenyon, James's brain, his aptitude for business, his willingness to make decisions, right or wrong, were welcome enough after Elizabeth's tedious procrastinations over trifles. For the first time in history, England and Scotland had been united, peacefully, under one monarch. But how would this work practically? Would they stay distinct? Or would they become amalgamated? Would they become equal partners? James wanted a full union. One monarch, one parliament, one law. There was opposition on both sides of the border. Scotland would be concerned about being simply incorporated into England. English opposition could be summed up with the words of MP Sir Christopher Pigott. "Scots are beggars, rebels and traitors." He was swiftly sent to the Tower. On the 16th of November 1603, James signed a decree creating a new Anglo-Scottish currency. The new 20-shilling piece called the Unite proved impractical, however, and James would be blocked from uniting the kingdoms. The Commons were completely against it. James was not used to political barriers, for in Scotland he had little. He had helped create a compliant Scottish Parliament. Beyond titles and flags, the countries would remain separate. The country was gripped with a far more pressing matter, religion. Both the Catholics and the Puritans were optimistic for change under James. He had given encouraging signs to Catholic nobles like Thomas Percy. The Puritans saw an opportunity to scourge Catholicism once and for all and presented the Millenary Petition to the King, signed by 1,000 ministers. While recusancy was already heavily fined during the twilight years of Elizabeth, they wanted the remaining remnants of Catholicism wiped clean. They demanded, among other things, the abolition of wedding rings, confirmation, the signing of the cross during baptism, and the word priest. At the Hampton Court Conference in 1604, the Puritan bubble was burst. Few points raised found their way into revised canons. James promised not to persecute any Catholics who obeyed the law and suspended fines for recusancy, the refusal to attend Anglican services. Puritans had hoped to duel with James, who was known for open debates when making decisions. Yet they lost the debate. The king said, "I will never allow in my conscience blood of any man be shed for diversity of opinion in religion, but I'll be sorry if Catholic numbers multiply, as they might be able to impose principles upon us." The true legacy of the Hampton Court Conference was the commission of a new translation of the Bible. The King James Bible was published 7 years later in 1611, with 55 scholars credited. It is considered one of the greatest achievements in the history of English literature, and one of its most important. It was comprised of simple vocabulary, to be accessible for all. The original mission of such early Protestant reformers of William Tyndale, from whom inspiration was taken when constructing the new Bible. Moreover, the scholars purposely searched for words that would not only read better, but sound better. It had a huge impact on the English language, producing far more than the works of William Shakespeare, including 257 idioms. Some examples include baptism of fire, going the extra mile, and the blind leading the blind. It is perhaps the most famous Bible translation in history, and one of the most printed works of all time. Meanwhile, back in 1604, with recusancy fines suspended, Catholics became more outspoken in their beliefs. James was under immense pressure. Accusations that James was not a true Protestant was too much. He caved. By February 1605, James had reintroduced penal laws on Catholics for recusancy. How the Catholics reacted was entirely new, a method all too familiar to the 21st century world. In the spring of 1604, Robert Catesby devised the gunpowder plot. Slowly he began to recruit conspirators, who would swear an oath of loyalty. 13 men in total. Catesby meant to blow up the Houses of Parliament on the 5th of November 1605, the day King James was due to open Parliament. With the king and the members of the houses dead, the conspirators would then kidnap James's 9-year-old daughter Elizabeth, marry her to a Catholic noble, and crown her queen, a puppet queen, to create a new Catholic kingdom. Among the conspirators was Thomas Percy, the man James had reassured when he came to claim his crown. Another was Guy Fawkes, an English Catholic mercenary who had fought for the Spanish in the 80 Years' War against the Protestant Dutch reformers. The plan was to rent a small house close to Westminster and dig a tunnel to stop directly under the Houses of Parliament. However, due to Thomas Percy's connections, an easier route was available. They instead rented a cellar underneath the houses in the building itself. The conspirators were set. One of those men, however, was about to make one of the most consequential decisions in British history. Francis Tresham, concerned that his brother-in-law, Lord Monteagle, would be attending the opening of Parliament and would certainly be killed, sent him a letter. It read, "My Lord, out of love I bear to some of your friends, I have a care for your preservation. Therefore, I would advise you, as you tender your life, to devise some excuse to shift your attendance at this Parliament, for God and man have concurred to punish the wickedness of this time. Retire yourself into your country, where you may expect the event in safety." The letter had been sent anonymously. A deeply suspicious Monteagle passed the letter on to Robert Cecil, who passed it on to James. Together, they decided not to cancel the opening, and instead to catch them in the act. When a search party reached the cellar on the afternoon of the 4th of November, they found Guy Fawkes, dressed in black, with his spurs strapped to his riding boots, in order to make a quick getaway, if required. Except Guy Fawkes was John Johnson, a mere domestic servant stacking firewood. The search party were fooled, and continued the search without checking what was underneath the firewood. However, when the second search party came at around midnight, Guy Fawkes was still there. Underneath those stacks of firewood, they found a full 36 barrels of gunpowder, with a calculated radius of 500 metres, easily enough to turn Westminster to rubble and annihilate all within. Guy Fawkes was arrested. With permission from the king himself, he was tortured for information. When asked how he could conspire so hideous a treason against his children and so many innocent souls who never offended him, he countered, "But a dangerous disease requires a desperate remedy." He intended to blow the king back to Scotland. Even during the early torture, Guy Fawkes was said not to be dejected, but often smiled in a scornful manner, repenting only his failure. He would not give up his co-conspirators lightly. He was given manacles, iron gloves worn and used to hang the victim up against the wall. They would be made to stand on wooden billets, which were kicked away from their feet one by one, leaving them dangling in agony. He was placed on the rack, a device which stretches the body, resulting in dislocations of arms and legs, leading to permanent damage. Guy Fawkes held out for 2 days before gradually revealing information. Eventually, he provided all the names. A signature before and after Guy Fawkes' torture shows a broken man, physically and mentally. The conspirators were hunted. Percy, Catesby, and others were busy trying to rally support in their desperate attempt to save themselves. They had dragged a cart of gunpowder with them that had been drenched in the rain. While they laid it out to dry, it sparked, blinding one of the conspirators. Finally, with little support generated, they were met with 200 soldiers in a last stand. Catesby and Percy were fighting to the death, back to back, when they were taken down with a single bullet. The rest were captured and put on trial, including Fawkes. They were hanged, drawn, and quartered. The brutal retribution was complete. The failed plot united the nation. The 5th of November became a national holiday, a date that was important to remember. Citizens were encouraged to light bonfires to celebrate the anniversary every year, a tradition that very much remains in British culture. In April 1506, James persuaded Parliament to adopt a new flag, the Union Jack, named after his own initials in Latin. The flag would be flown from British ships, though English and Scottish ships would still wave their respective flags. It wasn't just the conspirators who would experience retribution, but the entire Catholic population. A lord claimed that this bloody stain and mark will never be washed out of the Popish religion. One MP even suggested that Catholics be made to wear yellow hats and shoes. Thankfully, this was dismissed on the grounds of it being un-English. However, an oath of allegiance was introduced, making it almost impossible for a Catholic to serve in office without renouncing their faith. The authorship of the letter which doomed the entire plot has been a matter of dispute, with some even claiming it came from Cecil himself. Nevertheless, had the plot succeeded, the bomb would have wiped out the king and the entire ruling class. It is incomprehensible. With such an ill-conceived plan, the power vacuum it could have created would have undoubtedly led to utter anarchy far beyond the fragile, volatile years of the Wars of the Roses. But the plot was foiled, perhaps due to the conscience of one man. James had also inherited Elizabeth's thorny issues overseas. Almost immediately after ascending the throne, Robert Cecil opened peace negotiations with England's most fervent enemy, Spain. In preparation, perhaps, James had outlawed privateering and piracy. The Treaty of London in 1604 ended the 19-year Anglo-Spanish conflict. James and Philip III of Spain realised that peace would bring tremendous benefit for both nations. Without the pressures and dangers of privateering, the nations could coexist and benefit from colonialism in the Americas independently. London would become more prosperous as a result. It was a significant achievement for Robert Cecil, but with decades of anti-Spanish propaganda taking its toll on the English public, the treaty was hugely unpopular. Perhaps the man who benefited the most from the now banned practice of privateering, Walter Raleigh, was imprisoned for his loose connections to a plot to remove James as king back in 1603. James's resolve would also be tested in Ireland, an area where Elizabethan policy had largely failed. Peace between England and Spain was a blow for the Irish. They had lost a source of arms, supplies, and money in their fight for independence. Spain was unlikely to jeopardise a fresh peace treaty to help what was a rather insignificant island nation. In 1607, Hugh O'Neill, the man who had tormented Elizabethan councillors in the late 1590s, joined his fellow lords in the flight of the earls. They fled Ireland to the continent in the search for support. They got as far as Rome, but failed. Yet with the earls gone, James accelerated the Ulster plantation. English and Scottish settlers were replacing the native Irish in Ulster, who were being told to settle out west. This had a big impact in James's ability to control Ireland. Individuals and companies were allotted land. The town of Derry was sponsored by the Corporation of London, who affixed their sign at the entrance to the town, hence the name Londonderry. The impact of such movement of peoples has led to hundreds of years of ethnic and sectarian conflict, even to the present day in Northern Ireland. By 1606, after 13 years imprisoned, James released Walter Raleigh. Why? They struck a deal. Raleigh persuaded the king to allow him on a second expedition to the legendary land of El Dorado. Raleigh was obsessed with the enduring tale of a city of gold, whose fabulous chief, the Gilded One, was covered with gold dust, and the gold and precious jewels were thrown into the lake to appease a god that lived underwater. James would have the lion's share of the gold that Raleigh would return. The other significant concession for Raleigh was that he must not in any way, under any condition, be a pirate. The land was in present-day Venezuela and Colombia. He set sail in 1617. He found no gold. One of his captains then attacked a Spanish outpost. Raleigh's own son was killed in battle against the Spanish. The expedition was a total disaster. When he returned, he was beheaded. He was the very last figure of the Elizabethan Golden Age. As his execution was viewed as a way of appeasing the Spanish, Raleigh became a national hero. He became more popular than he ever was in life. While the public were becoming increasingly impatient with the king on his pro-Spanish policy, James's explorers could safely search for new lands. He provided a charter to the Virginia Company in 1606. In 1607, Jamestown was established, becoming the very first permanent English colony in the Americas. The English colonists would continue to bring home exotic products, but also Native Americans, one of which from the Powhatan people has become permanently fixed in popular culture, Pocahontas. She was the daughter of the chief kidnapped for ransom, baptized with a new name, Rebecca, and married to a wealthy tobacco merchant called John Rolfe at the age of 17. She was then presented to English society as a civilized savage in the spring of 1616. She was wined, dined, and taken to theatres. But why was she there? It was largely a publicity drive to bring investors to the Virginia Company. She also represented a false concept of good relations between natives and colonists. Pocahontas never made it home, dying at the age of 20 the following year of disease. She was buried at Gravesend in Kent. In 1620, a group of disgruntled Puritans answered the call to the New World. They became known as the Pilgrim Fathers, setting sail on the Mayflower, establishing the Plymouth Colony in modern-day Massachusetts. By the late 1610s, James's reputation was wavering. He was the antithesis of Elizabeth. He was seen as rude, blunt, scruffy, and unkempt. He once told a Scottish Presbyterian minister that he gave not a turd for his preaching. His court was uncouth, known for its drunkenness and debauchery. This Parliament could ignore, yet their biggest issue with James was his spending. He severely lacked in self-discipline. He would regularly host parties spending large sums on alcohol, court entertainment called masks, and banquets for seriously inebriated guests. James himself was an alcoholic. He was just as liberal with his spending elsewhere. Between 1603 and 1607, he spent £180,000 on jewels, £85,000 on country houses, and £20,000 on his coronation. By 1620, he had totalled an eye-watering debt of anywhere between £500,000 to £1 million. He drove Robert Cecil mad. It was clear that James was ignorant to his real expenditure. In 1610, in an attempt to save James's finances, he proposed the Great Contract to Parliament. James would give up his feudal rights for guaranteed income from Parliament. They wouldn't budge, and Parliament dissolved. It would become a familiar pattern, a pattern Matt Cecil would not witness. He died in 1612, probably of utter exhaustion. After all, James, not dissimilar to Henry VIII, liked to delegate duties and responsibilities and enjoy finer leisurely activities, such as hunting. With Cecil gone and money becoming a serious issue, James continued to butt heads with Parliament. He was still of the opinion that he had a divine right of rule and Parliament should be largely compliant. This was not likely to happen, and instead of compromise, James became more obstinate. He would literally tear members' bills up in front of their faces. They met only when James wanted, and didn't meet at all between 1614 and 1621, by which point only a tenth of royal income came from taxation. James took to age-old tricks of raising money, such as selling honours, knighthoods, and inventing minor hereditary titles. He also heavily taxed tobacco. He even wrote a treatise damning the substance, a custom he called loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, dangerous to the lungs, a filthy novelty. But while Parliament and James were permanently at loggerheads, the rest of the country was experiencing peace. Early Stuart England was perhaps the least violent country in Europe. There were no brigands, no bandits, no armed vagabonds. There was a respect for institutions of justice, and this prevented perpetual violence. Riots were declining in frequency and intensity. Response to disorder was largely muted, with suspended sentences becoming common, often imposed because such riots offered absolutely no threat to the existing social order. By the end of the 1610s, inside the walls of Westminster, James's court was becoming embroiled in scandal. At one point in 1619, the former Lord Chamberlain, Treasurer and Secretary of State all languished in the Tower on charges of a financial or sexual nature. James, throughout his life, had had a tendency to cultivate favourites. This was also becoming an issue. In 1614, James met 21-year-old George Villiers. The 48-year-old king was besotted. James would call George Steenie, after St. Stephen, who is said to have had the face of an angel. Much has been made of the nature of their relationship. Some clues have been provided by contemporaries. One observed that he had never seen any fond husband make such a great dalliance over his beautiful spouse as I have over his favourite, George. Another claimed that James would tumble and kiss him like a mistress. By 1616, James had made him a viscount. By 1623, George was a duke. It was a meteoric rise. It also coincided with his ever-distant relationship with his wife, who was seeing less and less of each other. Their rift wasn't helped when Anne reportedly shot James's favourite dog, accidentally, when out hunting together. As for George's colleagues, whenever one courtier grows close to a ruling monarch, they become the most hated figure at court, a natural enemy for grasping counsellors. This was no exception. When confronted over his relationship, the king would defend himself. "You may be sure that I love George more than anyone else, and more than you, who are here assembled. Christ has his John, and I have my George." In later years, James was becoming more and more dominated by his favourites. George, knowing that the king was fading, became attached to his heir. Prince Henry had died in 1612 at the age of 18. The dashing, popular, esteemed heir had been replaced with a mumbling, unimpressive younger brother, Charles. Members of the Howard family, sympathetic to Roman Catholicism, suggested Charles marry Maria Anna, the youngest daughter of Philip III of Spain. Her huge dowry could be used to pay off James's debts, but more importantly, The match would go a long way in securing a perhaps ambitious goal of reconciling with Rome. Francis Bacon, the Lord Chancellor, led a bitter campaign against the match. A disgruntled James let Parliament know that their purview lay no further than domestic policy making. Bacon was impeached. A stubborn James, influenced by George, even arranged Spanish lessons for Charles, including dancing classes. In February 1623, the soon-to-be Duke of Buckingham, George Villiers, travelled with Charles incognito to the royal house of Spain. Maria Anna was completely underwhelmed by Charles, and their terms for the union included a repeal of the English penal laws against the Catholics, and for Charles himself to convert to Catholicism. The pair knew that an agreement was far beyond an increasingly impatient English Parliament, and may return to England without a bride for the heir. Instead, Charles would marry Henrietta Maria, the sister of Louis XIII of France. A treaty was signed in 1624. Parliament were largely tricked, as a secret term was agreed in suspending the operation of the penal laws. It was a sign of things to come in the reign of Charles. The last year of James's reign was dominated by a single issue which had been completely evaded: war. The husband of James's daughter Elizabeth, Frederick, claimed the throne of Bohemia. His rival to the throne was the Holy Roman Emperor, an ally of Spain. Parliament and the public were thirsty for war. James was resistant. An ailing king did not want to declare war on a country with whom he had spent his entire reign trying to forge peace. The resulting parliamentary session in 1624 was left ambiguous. James's time was almost up. In his final years, James was suffering from gout, arthritis, and kidney stones. He drank heavily. Due to his ill health, he was becoming a peripheral figure in the ruling of the country, with Charles and the new Duke of Buckingham largely taking the reins. In early 1625, he suffered a stroke, and in March, he died, probably of dysentery. He was 58. He was buried at Westminster Abbey. According to revisionist anti-Stuart detractors, such as Charles Dickens, James was cunning, covetous, wasteful, idle, drunken, greedy, dirty, cowardly, a great swearer, and the most conceited man on earth. He was undeniably a genuine intellectual, perhaps the most intelligent monarch in British history. Yet with his intellect, his often poor decision-making, and naivety led to nicknames such as the wisest fool in Christendom. His legacy is strong. His ecumenical outlook did much to diffuse religious conflict and led to 20 years of relative peace. It was the first reign since the Norman conquest that saw no conflict overseas, and Charles's succession was perhaps the most peaceful and stable since Edward II in the 14th century. His reign was arguably the birth of English colonialism. By the end of James's reign, 80,000 settlers had arrived in the villages of New England, in one of the most significant migrations in human history. While James's achievements and legacy are very much still felt in the 21st century, his detractors claim his apparent absolutism, financial recklessness, cultivation of favourites, and his insistence of the divine right of kings were the foundations of what was about to follow: the Civil War. Thank you for listening. Join us next time for Charles I. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at Kings Queens Pod, now on Instagram, Kings Queens Podcast. And if you'd like to send a question in, you can do so on those platforms, or you can send an email to the Kings and Queens Podcast at gmail.com. And I will see you next time.